There are those professors who have lived their lives by such strong aesthetic passions that they inspire their students to consider, to simply consider that in place of religion, in place of therapy, in place of yogis or nuns or any form of organized transcendental activity, there was art. Before any of those things were created, there was always art. So that the museum, the library, the jazz club, the theater, the film, the poem, the novel meant empowerment and transcendence. These professors inspire their students to consider, take a moment. Literature might just have the fingerprints to our happiness, so that we are no longer students, and they themselves are no longer professors. We are no longer administrators or sales clerks or janitors or policemen. In literature, we can be elevated, we can be transformed, made different. We can all become heroic figures. I can only guess that for our esteemed guest today, Richard Price, such a professor was Archie Ammons. I did not know Archie Ammons other than reading his poems and knowing that he was one of the 20th century's greatest poets. He had already left to the stars by the time I arrived at Cornell. But from what I've heard from his students and everyone who has met him, he shook their lives like a devastation, both in intellect and in kindness. It is well known here at Cornell that Archie Ammons will hold court at the Temple of Zeus, which still exists today in a different incarnation. And it was there where Ammons will share his knowledge, his kindness, his wit, and his humor with anyone who wished to participate. A few years ago, Richard Price was once a member of that court. It was there that Ammons, a poet from the South, whose work mainly sang to the humanities' relationship with nature, that somehow spoke to Richard Price, a kid from the projects of the Bronx. It did not matter to Richard that Ammons' work was about the leaf, the snow, the tree, the moss, the weed, the tick, the icicle. Somehow he knew that in literature, we are all writing, we are all speaking, and we are all living under the same cathedral. This afternoon, Richard Price has returned to Cornell to share with us Ammons' influence in his pursuit towards a career in writing, a career which is now is as illustrious as Ammons. Richard Price has written many screenplays, among them Sea of Love, Ransom, Mad Dog and Glory, Shaft, and was nominated for an Academy Award for my personal favorite, The Color of Money, about two pool hall hustlers played by Paul Newman and Tom Cruise with a kick-ass soundtrack full of rock and roll aristocracy. You have Don Henley, Eric Clapton, Warren Zevon, Robbie Robertson, B.B. King. It continues at Mark Knopfler, Robert Palmer, produced by Jeff Lynn, an amazing soundtrack. He has also not just written screenplays, but he's also written 9 novels, of which Clockers was nominated for a Book Critics Circle Award. And his latest novel, The Whites, just arrived in 2015 under a pseudonym, which I just read. He now wishes he wouldn't have done that. Good question to ask him later. He has also received the American Academy of Arts and Letters Award. He has also received a Writers Guild Award for the 5th season of The Wire. Let me tell you, when the Writers Guild Award gives you an award, you got to be great. I mean, this guild, this union is basically full of writers, jealous writers. And they don't want to give awards to nobody but themselves. So I always say, oh, it's a technical error. That's why I was not nominated. Yeah. So Richard Price is great. He is an amazing author, And before I give way to Richard, I would like to take a moment for a personal anecdote. This is my copy of The Wanderers from high school. And what I found in this book was things that spoke to me, people that I knew, people that were similar to the people that I dealt with in Spanish Harlem. It was very exciting to me to read about the subways that I took, to read about places that I knew. And what this book was a blueprint. And I thought maybe if I work hard enough, I can do something like this too. Maybe not at the same level as Richard, but that is okay. I'll be living in that cathedral. And though I will not have a stained glass, it's okay. I'll just have a little pew. I was just happy to be there. I find it fitting to quote one of your screenplays, a line from one of your screenplays, which was made into a movie, of course. It is from a wonderful three shorts called New York Stories. And it's really the best one is the one with Scorsese, written by Richard Price. The other two are okay. The Woody Allen one is okay. And the Coppola one is not worth watching. Totally. I am telling you the truth. It is called Life Lessons, and it is about a torture painter played by Nick Nolte. And Richard Price makes a cameo towards the end of that movie. And he says something that I always found very poignant, very humorous, and I would like to quote it today. But instead of saying your paintings, I would like to say your novels. So Richard, I'm a writer too. When I look at your novels, you make me want to divorce my wife. With you now, Richard Price.
Listen, man. That was fantastic. That was the best introduction I've ever had. I think is my microphone on? Because I was saying all this catty stuff, and all of a sudden, it was like a Robert Durst moment. I was just talking crap to my wife, and so on and so on. What did I do? I killed them all. Of course. So thank you so much for that introduction. There are people that inspired me to write The Wanderers, and that fact that I could inspire other, young guys to women, anybody, of any species, to become a writer or feel like, if this guy did this, I can do something too. I used to feel that way about Richard Brautigan when I was an undergraduate in the late 60s, because his crap was so hippie-ish. I figured if this guy can get published, I cannot believe I can't get published. But that's not your reasoning, I understand. It's ironic that I'm here. Well, not ironic, it is. I was an ILRE. I was in this building from 1967 to 1971, and I could not find the entrance because this... This part didn't exist. And ILR at that point was called either Long Island High, because everybody was from five towns, or it was called What'd You Get You? Like when the test results would come into the cubbyhole, they'd be like, What'd you get? Fun for the whole family. I want to just start out. I don't think I can talk as eloquently as was spoken about Archie Ammons, but I never took a class with him. I was in labor relations. I always wanted to be a writer. I was told by my family, grew up in the Depression. We lived in a housing project, and it was impossible to get validation for becoming a writer if your family remembers going through the coats in the closet to find a quarter to buy a quart of milk. So if you said to them, well, I want to be a writer, I want to be a poet, I want to be a dancer, I want to be an actor. So do I kill you now, or do I wait to calm down and then kill you calmly? They just said, what are you talking about? The whole point of college was economic security. You go out, there's a job waiting for you, there's an interview, there's something with a pension. And I was like a sneaky writer. I would take my one ILR elective in some creative writing class. And I had some great teachers here. There's going to be some funny names. Is anybody here from class of 71 or earlier? Thank you. So, I'm at least equally with someone else, the oldest person in the room. But I take all my there was a teacher, I had a teacher named Joanna Russ, who I think had a wooden leg and was one of the most, and she just died the other day, and she was one of the most important gay feminist science fiction writers, you know, of whatever. And then I had a guy named Ronald Sukunik, who graduated in 1958, and he was here when Pynchon was here, and Richard Farina, and Steve Capps, and all these guys who became teachers, and Joanna Russell came back at that time. And Ronald Sukunik was, he's a hippie, you know, and I, from the Bronx, it's like, oh, you always dress nice. If you're going to grow a protest beard, you know, make sure it's neat. You know, if you're going to wear an army fatigue jacket, not one with too many blood spatters on it. This Vietnam era, and I remember my father coming to Sukunik's, in my junior, senior years, I took creative writing seminars with him, and my father came, and he wore a jacket and a tie because it was a professor, and Sukunik came in with a T-shirt, a leather vest, and no shoes, and he put his feet up on, and my father almost just decomposed, you know, like on Star Trek, you know, when the atoms, you go like that. He was horrified, and I was going, ain't he cool? But I had some great teachers here. And then about my junior years, 1969, there was the original Temple of Zeus. This is pathetic, the Temple of Zeus here. This is like, this is an abomination. It should not be called, it should be called the Temple of, you know, Amoco or Conoco or something. The original Temple of Zeus had reproductions of all the Elgin marbles. And it was long, and it was low, and in those years, it was filled with guys with, you know, plaid shirts, hey. But they had, like, hippie long hair and, you know, these Viking, you know, hanging mustaches. And all the girls wore these, like, you know, free flowing skirts and would bring in their, you know, big dogs. And, you know, and I was just like this conservative kid from the Bronx. And this was, like, my counterculture introduction to a world of counterculture. And when they started an open mic reading series on Wednesday afternoons, it all was about poetry. It was all about fiction. And anybody could go up to the mic. And in the audience at that time was Archie Ammons, who had won the National Book Award 20 years for two books, 20 years apart, and was a brilliant poet, nature-oriented poet, like, was, you know, Walter Sladoff, Baxter Hathaway, who ran Epic Magazine, you know, so there's all these elegant geezers there, you know, and they were, everybody else looked like, you know, some bedraggled Viking and his chick, you know, and I got up to the mic the first time, I didn't know anything about poetry, I was glib. So I would just do like that anything goes kind of Richard Brautigan poetry, oh, purple ostrich on Texaco plain. You know, why do thou torment me with your war dead? You know, you don't like that one? Here's another one. You know, oh, alligator, and, you know. But every time, and it was the first time I was in front of a microphone, and every time I looked into this audience, there was Archie Ammons. And if anybody doesn't know what he looks like, think Walker Percy. He was a tall, thin, elegant North Carolina guy, and he had who was bald with a red fringe, and he always wore conservative slacks and a sport jacket and comfortable shoes, and he would be laughing every time I read, and it was thrilling. But everybody else, see, all the hippies are like, you know, that was applause. And I knew who Archie Ammons was because I'd read his 1962 book of poetry, Corson's Inlet. And I would go there every week, and my practical thing of being a lawyer or, you know, a Blue Cross management guy, you know, he started getting chipped away at. So by the time I was about to graduate, and Goldwyn Smith Hall, room 264, was Archie's office. And this man, it was like as narrow as a shoebox, and this man would sit there with his door open, in his open Oxford shirt and his sport jacket and his, you know, sensible slacks, just from 9 to 5, it felt like, waiting for somebody who wanted to talk to him. It was astounding. And I finally worked up the nerve, because I had to apply to graduate school, and I came into his office, and, you know, I said, "Professor Ammons, I know you've heard me read, you know, a bunch of times at the Temple of Zeus, but I want to ask you, do you think I could be a writer? And I'm butchering Rilke, and I'm butchering Archie Ammons." But he said to me, "Well, what, well," because it's Southern, there's an H after every W, "well, as Rilke said to the young poet, if you can think of anything to do but write, do that thing. If not, write." And like, in other words, dude, it's up to you. But, you know, long story short, it was enough for me, and I, you know, went off to write, and I published my first novel, and they sent it to him as a thank you, and he wrote back a blurb that was so sweet and generous about my book to my publisher. And he had typed his blurb on a postcard. I mean, we're talking, you know, manual typewriter. And you had signed it. And he was just this wonderful, supportive man that had more, as much to do with me becoming a writer as any human on earth. But the greatest thing about Archie is that in 2000, when I came back to teach in the English department, he was sort of retired, but nobody would ever take his office away. And I came up with my 13-year-old daughter, and I was trying to, like, you know, tease out the creativeness in her, and she started writing these little daughterly things that were kind of cute. And I wanted her to meet Archie Ammons. I had no idea how sick he was. And his secretary called and said, "Archie, we'll see you at 8 in the morning." "I don't see anybody at 8 in the morning." I said, "Can we make it later?" She's in his pregnant porch. She said, "Archie, we'll see you at 8 in the morning." I said, "Oh, okay." And I went to this little shoehorn office with my 13-year-old daughter, who really didn't have any intentions of being a writer. She's an actress now, but. And Archie sat there, and he was a year away from death. And he came in just to talk to my 13-year-old girl. And he said, "Genevieve, I understand you're something of a poet." And she was like, bleh, bleh, bleh. She didn't know anything. She wanted to see the girls' basketball team. And he proceeded for 45 minutes talking to my 13-year-old daughter occasionally. But he came in to see this little girl. And he very gently, very courteously and bravely basically said, "Well, you know, I have cancer, some kind of brain cancer." And I said, "Well, can you still write your poetry?" He said, "Regrettably not." And that was my last living memory of Archie. I came up for his memorial service at Sage Chapel. And it was basically a lot of senior English department guys were there. And everybody was assembled. He was so beloved. And it opened up with, through the speakers, was Archie Ammons' voice going, "Well, I guess you're wondering why I brought you here." You know, and then, you know, everybody came up and just, and after that, everybody from the chapel walked in a procession to Goldwyn Smith Hall, to room 264, which is his office, and the door was open, the chair was angled, just like he used to, he would sit, like, half looking at the door, and half looking at his desk. And his hat, he had a little, like, you know, tweedy fedora. And I don't know if there was a pipe there, but just all the things that anybody who knew Archie were there. And people just stood in front of the door, like, silently, you know, and then they went home. So thank you, Archie, for living. You gave me life. What I'd like to do, okay, I'd like to read for about 15, 20 minutes and open it up to questions. What I'd like to read from is my worst novel, The Breaks. And the only reason why I'd like to read is the prologue is about the Arts Quad, the Arts, oh I'm doing my quad, the Arts Quad spring graduation 1971. It was based on it. I call Cornell Simon Strait College the Harvard of upstate New York. And it has one, as my wife told me, don't read anything with too many characters. Nobody's going to follow it ever. But I'm going to try. And it just, those of you who went through graduation, I hope you laugh a little bit. It's also about what it's like it's also a tribute to my father, who basically, he got a general diploma from a public high school in the Bronx and never did anything else. And I was the first person in my family ever to go to college. So for him, it was like to be here at my graduation. Like, I was bored out of my mind, but, he's a narrow man. He had a 54-inch chest that day. And it's also the culture clash between, the more genteel Midwestern and urbane families that sent their kids to Cornell and, the schmoes from the Bronx. There we were, scattered around the Arts Quad, the proud men and women of Simon Strait College class of 1971, 1,000 gowns, casually smoking joints and playing frisbee with their mortarboards as their parents shook hands under the trees. In the 93-degree heat, my own gown felt like a horse blanket, but I'd have sooner set myself on fire than lowered the zipper that was gnawing my Adam's apple. After three generations of Teamsters, cabbies, and mailmen, the Kellers had finally scored for a college graduate. I was the happy ending to our private little American everyman play. That doesn't even make any sense. I don't think the everyman play. I was young. I had worked construction every summer, was in hock up to my ass with student loans. With all that, my father still wound up paying through the nose, but that was the way it was. 4 years earlier, we had sat down with my three acceptance letters and decided that if we were going to do it up, we would do it up right. I could have gone to Fordham University on a half scholarship or CCNY for free, but from where we were coming, a Simon Strait car sticker was priceless. My father was standing within earshot of me, talking to Larry Arthur's old man under the shadow of the runny, bright green copper founder's statue. Mr. Arthur was the only guy my father recognized. They had met my junior year over parents' weekend at the fraternity house. They weren't what I would call soulmates, but George Arthur was hard to forget. He was 6'9". This is my father talking, and the characters, I'm Pete. Yeah, well, Peter got on the waiting list for Columbia Law School, but he figures, and I kind of agree, that instead of going to some ambulance chaser factory on short notice, he's going to move back in with us, get a good one-year job, save his money, get a nice bank account going, and reapply next year. This way, he'll be a year more mature, experienced, because they like that, kids who've been out in the world. He can pay his own tuition, and like that. My father tapped a cigarette on the toe of the founder's shoe, slipped the butt into the corner of his mouth, and hiked up the skirt of his jacket by slipping his hands into his front pants pocket. He had tilted his head to the side as he talked because Mr. Arthur had a good 10 inches on him. And I'll tell you, I myself am pretty impressed with Pete's maturity. I think it's unusual these days with all this shit going on, he murmured, slurred the word shit, for a kid to be that sensible, you know? In addition, of course, his stepmother would love to have him around for another year. Mr. Arthur chuckled politely, his eyes briefly darting from my father to some other parents. Look, I'll be perfectly frank with you, Mr. Arthur. He squinted in candidness and touched his own chest with his fingertips, his unlit cigarette bouncing between his lips. We're very, very proud of Peter. He held out his hand to Mr. Arthur's chest, as I'm sure you are of Larry. But I am not an educated man. I've been working the post office for 20 years. He grimaced. George Arthur was a patent attorney. In fact, Pete's the first kid in our family, all my cousins' kids, everybody, the first one to go to college. And we got in this place, what do they call it? The Harvard of upstate New York? We were fit to bust. So even if he goes no further, you know what I mean? We'll see what happens. But for now, I admire that kid's sensibleness. I really do. Mr. Arthur squinted in acknowledgement. He had a silvery, slightly sloppy William Buckley crop. My father had a jet black pompadour fronting for an almost totally bald crown. Both my father and Mr. Arthur were dressed in their tribal costumes. old George in Kelly green slacks and a loud patchwork summerweight sports jacket, my father in a blue and white double knit suit and white Tomic Ann loafers. And this is shifting to me and my two roommates. Yo, Pete, two gowns weaved across the grass towards me. I spit on my fingertips and ran them down my cheeks so they'd look like tear slicks. This is the proudest day of my life, Larry. Yeah, me too. Bam Bam, tell them what happened. You know that check I got from the phone company? What check? The return of our deposit from September. It bounced. The Alexander A. Graham Bell Telephone Company. Their freaking check to me bounced. Heads up, he shouted as they ducked a mortarboard that went screaming by like Odd Job Steel Derby. Mortarboard frisbee was catching on. The entire quad was zipping with low-flying caps, tassels erect with momentum. Stay down, Bam Bam snagged one backhand as I remained in my squat. Bam Bam, my man, a fat, handsome wop, first-generation Scarsdale. So this is the proudest day of your life, Pete? Larry was already grinning, halfway to a laugh. I'm serious, man. It was rough. My goddamn father delivered ice to fifth floor walks up in the Lower East Side to get me through here. Ice, he chuckled. Yeah, Larry, ice. I shook my head sadly. You know, and his bad leg is one thing, man, but I don't know if you ever noticed it, but he's got artificial arms, my father. The idiot actually looked over to where my old man was standing talking to his. You crack me up, he said tentatively. Well, now he's got artificial arms. I mean, real artificial arms. But up until 2 years ago, he couldn't even afford them, man. He had pliers bolted into his shoulder sockets. Do you have any idea what it must feel like to lug a cake of ice up five flights of stairs with freaking pliers for arms? I hunched up as if to make my shoulder caps kiss across my chest. Do you know what hell that plays with your lower back? He cracked up like the Midwesterner he was. Actually, even Bam Bam started laughing. A cool breeze wafted across the quad. It felt wonderful, hopeful. I love you guys, I suddenly blurted, surprising myself. And to cover my embarrassment, I grabbed them both in headlocks, and we clinched in a clumsy huddle of affection. Over their bowed heads, I saw my stepmother, Vi, standing by herself, smiling, lost, holding her purse in front of her pleated skirt with both hands. Vi. As usual, her hair was lifted, teased, and frozen into an iridescent rust helmet. She'd been going to a beauty parlor every day since I'd known her, but instead of making her look hard, it accentuated her breakableness. She had a fragile, tentative face, shining eyes under eyebrows dyed to match her hair, and permanently arched in some kind of wet expectation, nostrils all flared under a sharp, narrow bridge, nose all flared, nostrils under a sharp... Nose all flared nostrils under a sharp, narrow bridge, lips parted and slightly tremulous over buck teeth. She was only 5 feet tall and a living testament to the expression, terror makes you slender, since she weighed in at 98 pounds. My real mother had tipped the scales at 250, soaking wet. Vi never touched or held an object. She gripped. She never turned to a voice. She whipped around. Everything about her promised a nervous breakdown, and in the 5 years that she'd been married to my father, I always felt at least half bad about never, quote, extending myself, but that was that. He's just talking about Bam Bam, who's this, you know, Italian up from working class roommate, and Larry, who's Mr. Arthur's son, who's, you know, from Gentry. The three of us had been in Pi Omega, a Jewish house. Bam Bam got in because New York Italians were honorary Jews, and Larry got in as one of the token Midwesterners. Jewish fraternities had a hard-on for WASPs. They couldn't tell the difference between a good guy and a jerk, everybody being temporarily blinded by all that blonde hair. If Larry had been 2 teaspoons more together, he would have probably gotten rushed by one of the American houses, where everybody brought their lacrosse sticks down to breakfast. So, at this point, So, Mr. Pete, Bam Bam smiled, I'll save you a carol at the law school. I felt my heart descend, and all I could manage was a wink. I loved Bam Bam like a brother, but it killed me that he had gotten into Columbia, and all I got was, the best I could do was a waiting list. I graduated with honors in English, Dean's List, and it was all Bam Bam could do to scrape up a B average as a labor relations major. But his father was a big shot with the Teamsters, and Bam Bam was smart enough to make a lot of noise on his application about wanting to be a labor lawyer. That recommendation from George Meany, his father managed to score for him, probably didn't hurt either. Bam Bam was no dope. He'd probably make a great lawyer. As for me, I had nobody to blame for my waiting list status but myself. The night before the law boards, I picked up, I got hammered in College Town and crawled into the examination room at 7 a.m. the next morning with my eyeballs hanging out of my head. I'd been accepted at my safety school, St. John's, but nobody ever went to their safety. I had to reapply next year. I had to wait it out. "Pete," Larry whispered, "check it out." He bent down and raised the hem of his gowns to his knees. He was wearing pants legs, only up to his shins. Apparently, he was nude from the kneecaps up. "You're an asshole, Larry." This is Bam Bam's family. "Tommy," from 30 feet away, Bam Bam's mother bawled out his name in her cigarette rasp as if she were yelling from a fifth-floor window. She stood there holding a camera under her arm like a football helmet, a tough, dark, wiry lady wearing a silk blouse, an outrageous slit maxi skirt, and high heels. She had permanently smoky rings under her eyes. Mrs. Sarah caught me staring absently at her slit skirt, and she tilted her chin in my direction. "What are you looking at, hot stuff?" I laughed, blushed, and waved her away. "You got a nice roommate, Tommy. He's trying to look up my dress." "Cut the crap, Ma." Far above Cayuga. I stood there watching Bam Bam get into a pose for his mother with his little brother, Bam Bam the Second, and his father, Big Bam Bam. The three of them stacked up, the kid on his knees, Bam Bam in a shortstop crouch over the kid's head, and Big Bam Bam behind them, standing erect, chest puffed out in pride, fists on hips. Without moving his body or a smile, Bam Bam murmur yelled for me to join the picture. I made like I didn't hear. Mrs. Bambara was probably the only camera bug who could squeeze off a shot with a cigarette butt hanging from her lips. She barked, "Freeze," and I heard the whining whir of a Instamatic photo rolling out of a Polaroid. The three Bam Bams crowded around her and started yelling at the picture to develop faster. I moved toward my father, who was still bending Mr. Arthur's ear with more up from Ellis Island crap. I listened to him run down how his mother's older sister had bought it in the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of 1911. If my family had to design a family crest, it would be crossed AFL and AFL-CIO and CSEA union cards on a field of time clocks. "So, what's Lenny's plans?" my father said. "Larry," Mr. Arthur gently corrected. "Larry." My father was feeling good. I can hear him play Jingle Bells with the change in his pockets as he rocked back and forth on his heels. "Well, Larry will be staying with myself and his mother this summer. We live outside of St. Paul." "St. Paul?" My father raised his eyebrows. "And come September, I think he's heading out west to California." "California?" He raised his eyebrows again. He was waiting for Mr. Arthur to continue, but Arthur just smiled. "Does he have a job out there, or is he going for the girls?" he had. "That's my dad." Last paragraph. "Well," Mr. Arthur gave another mild chuckle. "Neither, actually. I guess he squeezed his way into Stanford Medical School." "That's great," my old man said weakly, the jingle bells losing their beat, then picking up again double time. "That's great." I got hit on the arm with the point of a flung mortarboard, then whipped it back so hard that the guy opted for ducking. Those things can really freaking travel. That's it. I spent a month with my editor, Simon Schuster, who is this feisty guy from Texas A&M, named Herman Golub, trying to figure out a title for this book. And so we're sitting there, throwing out titles. I just remember at one point he looked at me and he said, "Come to me." And he went, "Oh, shit." And then he realized he's just coming up with a title. and that's all I have to say about the breaks. So at this point, I'd love to open it up to questions. Anybody? Yes.
So Richard, have you secretly written poetry anytime?
Yes, I did. I when I was at Cornell, I wrote poetry, but just like I said, I knew nothing about poetry. I didn't understand structure. I'd never read Eliot. I barely read Whitman. I don't even think I read Whitman. I thought Ginsberg. I knew about Ginsberg, but I didn't know about Whitman. You know, and I liked the, you know, what I thought the short. It was short, you know, and I didn't have a thought in my head, so it seemed perfect for me. I just didn't know. I never heard of The Wasteland. I loved Yeats. But I was very ignorant. And I just wanted to write. You know, I didn't care what I wrote. You know, and I look back on my sophomore year and I see that poetry I gave in, it's just, it's not even execrable. It doesn't make, you know, it's a waste of ink and it's a waste of trees. But yes, I started writing poetry. The thing that changed me from writing doggerel to trying to get a little more focused is that when I was 11 in 1961, I had a cousin who's 26 years old named Paul, and he was 6'4", blonde, and a weightlifter. And I had just saw him, and he came to my house for my sixth grade dance party in the projects, and he blew up the balloons, and, you know, he wrote in soap, you know, in the mirror, you know, congratulations, PS41 grads. You know, sixth grade. And then a week later, my parents came to me in the morning and said that Paul was dead. And I was, what? I had never known a dead person before when they were living. He said he died of a heart attack, and that's what I thought. And when I went to Cornell in 69 or 70, my father came up to drive me from Ithaca back to the Bronx. And in the car, I had mentioned to him that, you know, I smoked a joint. And he got so freaked out, he almost drove the car off the road. And I was going, you know, listen, everybody's smoking. What's the difference? You know, but I couldn't understand his overreaction. I knew he was a very conservative guy. But I saw Paul's older brother, Stanley, who was about 40 at this point. And I told Stanley about my father and his overreaction. He says, well, it was probably because of Paul. I said, what are you talking about? Paul died of a heart attack. I said, who told you that? He died of a heroin overdose. And in fact, it wasn't even a heroin overdose. He was given a battery acid, which is when they want to kill somebody. Instead of giving them heroin, they give them something that looks like heroin, but in fact will kill them. And with that realization, all of a sudden I got focused on what I didn't know in the world. And so my poetry shifted from purple Texaco ostrich or flamingo to starting to write tentative poems about the Bronx. And I became haunted by where I've been and what I didn't know. And it really, for the first time, made me want not just to have the label of writer, but to actually be a writer who says something. And that was the beginning of my life, finding out that my cousin died of an overdose. But that was started out in poetry. There was a little literary magazine called Rainy Day. It was a student, is it still exists? You know, and they had just these unbearably artsy, you know, like things on the cover, like an empty rocking chair or someone going like this, you know. But, you know, I saw my name in print and I went crazy. In fact, the first copy of Rainy Day was sent to a mailbox where my parents had a sort of a summer house in near Peekskill, New York. And I went to the mailbox and I saw it and I saw my name. And I was so shaking, I was reached out of there and didn't realize that this is not air, this is glass wall. And I knocked myself out. I've been knocking myself out ever since. So, yeah, that's the name of that tune.
Richard?
Yes.
I'm wondering if you've been thinking of Baltimore in the last week?
I'm assuming that's code for Eric Garner, for Ferguson, for some guy in custody, police custody.
Just Baltimore this week. I mean, not the whole.
I don't know about Baltimore this week. I just know about the police, the guy dying in police custody.
The guy dying in the police station.
Yeah. You know, people.
This is an opening to talking about The Wire and Baltimore. And
well, I'm not. I'm more about New York, and you know, I write a lot about police investigations. You know, but people have been asking me, what do I think about, you know, Ferguson and Eric Garner? And it seems, and I don't really know what to say because, I mean, I spend a lot of time with cops, but, and I understand some of the mentality of it, but I don't know what to say. I mean, it is what it is. The chips should. Hmm. Well, listen, you know, I know this about police, and we saw this in Staten Island, we saw this at Ferguson, Missouri, after, you know, two unmentionable deaths, is that it's not about right or wrong. I think police tend to have an us versus them attitude, and this us versus them has to do that they're armed, they're the biggest gang in America, city by city, but they feel like they're. Did my thing just go off, or did I? Okay. I feel like they have to be aggressive. They can't back down because if you show weakness, you know, the animals will be all over you, is the attitude. And, but they double down on that when, right or wrong, whatever they did, they sense they're being attacked not only by the people around them, but by the media, and they close ranks. This is not the thin blue line. This is not like we protect our own, but they just close ranks. And it's not about, was it murder or was it an arrest? It's just they're being attacked. And there is this fortress mentality that takes place. And I think every police chief everywhere right now after Ferguson and Staten Island is they're racing each other to fire officers and apologize to everybody because the media will just slaughter that police department and just slaughter that town in terms of it's a symbol of civil rights and justice. It's Mississippi burning 2015. And I think it's, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. But after Ferguson, they're just going overboard to be the most socially sensitive and responsible police chiefs until the next thing happens. And it will.
Why did you use a pen name for your last novel?
Okay, why did I use a pen name? My novels take so long, and I meant this to be a quickie novel. It's sort of a genre novel that was what you see is what you get. And I wanted to signal that this was not a book like the others. This was supposed to be like a slim read that it's all surface. And it turned out not to be. It turned out to be just another book like the books I write. So, and by the time my book was done, it was too late to change the pen name, but I'm losing the pen name on every subsequent printing. It was just an ill-conceived idea, thinking that I could write any other way than I write. Yes?
Do you read other people's fiction?
Yeah. If you ask me who, I'm going to draw a blank, because when you ask a question like that, I draw blanks, but yeah, voluminously. I don't know who. I don't know what books I read. I read so much, I can't remember what I just finished. But I like, you know, just contemporary American fiction. Not to sound nepotistic, but one of my favorite American writers is my wife, Lorraine Adams, who had written Harbor about Algerian stowaways coming into Boston, and a second novel, Room in a Chair, which takes place in Iran, Afghanistan. And Washington, D.C. I like Smith Henderson, who wrote 4th of July Creek. I love Laurie Moore's work. My wife will kill me, but I love Philip Roth sometimes until I hate him. But then he writes something else. I go, hey, you know, wow, this is, oh, you jerk. And then, wow, this is really good. Are you doing it again? God damn you. You know, The Sun is this great sort of Western saga written by Philip Meyer. And it was just one of those good old... Oh, by the way, I was rejected by the Cornell MFA program. And I think Archie Ammons was behind that. And I think, here's how I think benignly about that. I had spent 4 years on campus. Maybe the people in the faculty who liked me felt it would be best for me to go somewhere else. And I went to Columbia, which was, it was the best experience in my life. But at the time, I went, you know, I rejected. Do you know who I am? Apparently they did, and they didn't accept me. maybe somebody else. Yeah.
Well, I've always been a great fan of Martin Scorsese, so I have to ask, what was it like working with him on The Color of Money?
It was a schlep. I mean, the project was a schlep, but I respect him so much, and the energy and the artfulness that goes into his films. He was great. I mean, Scorsese, he wanted to get to his shots, and he wanted to get to certain things. And he had enough confidence in himself that he said, write this, and let me get to my... He didn't, like, hover over... But at the same time, I'll give you a better example. When I was working on New York Stories, and it was a 40-minute movie with Nick Nolte, and... Scorsese just said, all right, look, we're going to do this fast. Why don't you come in with a beat sheet? Give me, you know, like the 10 major moments in this 40 minutes. And I gave him this list. I said, this, and he went and said, great, 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 crap, bait, great, bullshit, great, great, crap. All right, come back in 3 days. I went back, and it was like, great, 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 awful. Go in that corner there and rewrite that note. And I did, and he never questioned. He shot, you know, the screenwriter, what they do is so easily buried under 10 types of interpretation by the director, by the actors, by the cinematographer, by the editing room, and by the marketing anxieties of the studio. And you're lucky to see anything that resembles what you wrote. But with Scorsese, basically, it was all my words, you know, and I've never seen that. Rarely. I just wrote this movie that probably got the worst reviews last week, Child 44. And exactly. Everybody's like, huh? And it was based on a Russian historical thriller, Stalin era, 1953. And so I wrote it, you know, but it's based on a 400-page historical political thriller. And 400-page book has to be converted into a 120-page telegram. He said, she said, they move here, they're over there. You know, there's no writing in the screenplay. It's just stage direction and language. And, I did my best. And the director was, you know, a dour Dane. And so he loved the Stalin stuff. So he made everything as gray, green, and grim as possible. If anybody cracked a smile in that movie, the whole world would have fallen apart. And... he should have gone against the grain of that because, you know, listen, I got a million things and I'll stop now. But that movie sucked. Anyways, sorry.
I just wanted to ask how your study in IOR affected your writing.
It's an excellent question.
How did you segue into being a writer?
Well, ILR was actually great for me. And I didn't know it at the time because your knee-jerk fantasy is you should be a literature major if you want to be a writer. But I'm of the school that feels like the more you read the greats and you're 19 and 20 years old, the more demoralized you feel when you write your 19, 20-year-old crap. You know, I just read Nostromo or, you know, I just read whatever, just pick one. And I'm going home, and all I knew to write about was how I'm horny. I don't know what else to write about. You know, I go home, Thanksgiving, and I thought I was going to be happy to see my family, but I can't wait to get out of here. You know, and when I was teaching writing, all the undergraduates were writing that. But at least being in ILR, it forced me. You can't rush wisdom. You can't tell a 20-year-old, here's a trick to being 40 years old. You got to live, you know, and then you become a better writer. Talent aside, you become a better writer when you understand things. You understand nothing when you're an undergraduate. But Cornell, the ILR school was great, except for statistics and pension administration, some god-awful crap like that, because it forced me economics, sociology, social psychology. It was this historical, social, psychological core curriculum that forced me to learn about Earth, not, you know, green Earth, but, you know, the Earth that we live on and the people in it. And I think I didn't have a self-conscious bone in my body when I just wanting to write. I had no people to compare myself to. It was great. And I really felt like I got, believe it, it's a major that sounds like a straitjacket, but it was pretty great and pretty well-rounded. And I didn't have the money to go to, or the grades to get into arts and sciences anyhow. So the thing about ILR, it's a state college. You know, when your parents put the car sticker, it just says Cornell, not like Cornell with an asterisk. The easier part and the cheaper part to get into. It's not like Roger Maris, 61 asterisk. You know, it just says Cornell, you know. How I got into writing from an ILR, I was just in ILR because somebody came into my parents' hosiery store in the Bronx one day and talked about her son just got into the school at Cornell. And my mother came home that day and said, how'd you like to go to an Ivy League college? You don't even need good grades to get in. I don't know how I got in. First of all, I thought it was a school of public relations. And I thought I wanted to write ads, jingles, you know. And they thought that all through my interview, and I got accepted anyhow. You know, the Lord works in mysterious ways. And coming from, you know, Bronx public schools, to see this campus, my only frame of reference for a university was the Dobie Gillis show, a sitcom, you know, and there was a college campus on it. You know, I thought I died when I saw the school. You know, I just thought I must have died and been lifted to heaven or something. I was just so overwhelmed with excitement. And just being at Cornell in general over those 4 years, it's the first time I ever left home in my life. And it still had to be 21 before I left the state. Just the whole experience of being here and studying economics and studying government. And I remember taking a social psychology course, Sociology of Deviance. And there was a lot of jocks in a class. It was called Sluts and Nuts 201. And, you know, then there was also a geology class called Rocks for Jocks, you know, and, yeah, I got a little science in there, you know. It was just, the whole school just opened me up. I was still a bumpkin when I graduated, but it got me on my way. And I just felt, when it came time to graduate, when I was a senior, everybody in ILR is planning a law school and or business college. And my two best friends went to Harvard Business School. And I really wanted to be a writer, thanks to the Temple of Zeus, and thanks to feeling like, oh, I think I slightly have something I really want to say. And I applied to all kinds of teachers' colleges. I applied to law schools and this and that. And I got into about half of everything. And I applied to the MFA programs that were just starting out then. They weren't factories like they are now. They weren't, you know, careerist, you know, outlets. People actually wanted to write, you know, and weren't worried about their jacket photo if they were young enough. And I remember being in my parents' hosiery store and just hamleting up and down in front of the pantyhose, going, yeah, I really want to write. I know I got in here. And my father finally just exploded and said, oh, for Christ's sakes, go to your goddamn writing school already. So you go there 2 years. If nothing happens, then you go to law school. I said, do you mean it? I didn't say, thanks, Dad, or I'm in control of my destiny. I had to have him get so disgusted with my whining to give me permission. And once I realized that I was in a writing school and started writing and having novelists as teachers, you know, my identity, my sense of identity as a writer was wanting to be a writer, no nonsense, was established in me. And fortunately, I got published at 24. At that point, the median age of a first novel, the novelist writing their first novel, was 40. And so incredibly, I lucked out. I think a lot because I was writing about white working class housing project life. And nobody was writing about that. My hero, my model was Hubert Selby, Last Exit to Brooklyn. And so I got published at 24, and then that's it, I'm an author. But if I had not published that early, if I had to put in 10 more years driving cabs or waitressing or whatever you do, while all my friends went off to Harvard Business School, law school, were establishing themselves in the world, and I'm still driving a cab like a geriatric hippie, I don't know if I would have had the stamina in me, because I just came from a world where people had no context for a child becoming any kind of artist. They just were bewildered and terribly anxious about it. And I tell you what my uncle said to me, but I think there's kids in the audience, about being a poet. I'll send an email out.
I was curious if you feel the consumption of paper books versus electronic books has changed your consumption of literature, or you feel it's changed the population's consumption of literature. And a follow-up or an addendum to that is, have you seen these rich content books that are coming out now where when you mention a place, it'll show you a map and a picture of the place, and it's kind of a newer technology, but they're rich content books. So they're electronic books that take you to a whole other level.
Well, I'm just a little bit learning about the rich content books. So I'd rather than go into that, I feel, in my case, I read more with electronic books because it's so much easier to buy books. At the same time, it makes me more ADD around my reading experiences because I just bought 6 books in 10 minutes. And, you know, I forget, by the time I get to one of them, I have no idea what this book is. Why did I buy it? I know my wife is experimenting with writing a novel and enhancing it with connections to media and, you know, language, songs, and places. So she would know a lot more than I would about, you know, I didn't know that it had a name like that. But, I mean, there's a lot of anxiety that you're losing your audience.
They might have just made that name up.
Well, it works, you know, but, you know, she's actually addressing that. As a novelist, I should be buying books in bookstores, but I've just gotten so conditioned to buy ebooks, you know, but it's just easier for me to read.
What advice would you give to the English majors and the humanities majors who are maybe frightened about, you know, getting published or making a career for themselves?
Well, first of all, they shouldn't be frightened about getting published. They should be frightened about, am I a real writer? You know, you're jumping the gun. If you're thinking about being a writer and your first thought is, will I ever get published, you're not a writer.
No,
I'm not saying you are, but if that's your thought, and that's the product of these careerist MFA programs, that people are going in there, and it's like a job mark. You know, it's about connections and this and that. It's like a writer writes. You know, somebody said, well, how do you become a writer? And somebody said, you have to write a million words. It's very different being published and being a writer. I mean, being published is perhaps a reward for being a writer, but it's not being a writer.
Thank you.
So I'd say if you're a writer, you won't even ask that question because you write. You haven't, you know, you write because you have no choice, because you really want to write. And if you can't write, you're miserable.
I have a question about the difference between writing for movies and TV and music videos and writing novels. In terms of process, are you able to write a novel at the same time you're writing your movie?
No, I can't write. I can't write in two mediums at one time. You're going to break something. But, you know, I do understand the difference between writing a novel where I'm in control of it and its actual language and writing a TV pilot and a movie script where basically you're setting up stage directions, you know, for somebody else to execute. And I understand when I'm writing a screenplay, I have a screenwriter hat on, you know, and when I'm writing a novel, it's like good riddance to all that. But you got to make money. You got to live. Nobody can live off novel royalties unless you're, you know, James Patterson or somebody.
I have one last question.
Yes.
You collaborated with Spike Lee in Clockers. But that was your book, but you collaborated with him for the screenplay, but it was your book.
I didn't really collaborate with him. I wrote the screenplay for Scorsese and De Niro. When they dropped out, Spike Lee jumped in as director. I had already written a script, copious scripts, and he just took over, and he just did his script. So even though we have co-writing credit, that doesn't mean we wrote together. That means I wrote enough to deserve a credit, and then he did what he did. So when you see that little ampersand there or whatever, you know, usually that means somebody got fired and somebody took over. He made it worse. Well, glad you asked. I went through a period where I was estranged from my parents for a couple of years, including a year I published my book. And at this point, my father was a window dresser. He worked for Modell's. He would put the clothing in the window and just do all the decor. It was not like Barney's, it was Modell's, you know. It was like Dick's Sporting Goods. And he had a store in Times Square, and I was walking through Times Square one day, and I hadn't seen my father for a couple of years. And I passed him in the window, you know, tacking up running jackets. And I walked past, and I was in shock, and then I walked back, and he was there, and he had his mouth filled with pins, and he just spewed all the pins out. And we had a reunion of sorts, and I thought it was a real big shot because I got a $4,000 advance, and I had a credit card. And so he introduced me to all the other window dressers, all these guys named, you know, Morty and Ben. You know, like I said, this is not Barney's. And I said, well, let's have a drink. And so he was not a big drinker at all. So we went to, you know, some Times Square, you know, semi-respectable restaurant. And we're sitting at a table, and I was going to show off. I had my credit card. And I ordered like a tequila hummingbird or, you know, one of these like Harvey Wallbanger or whatever they were drinking in 1971 when you had no idea what drinking was about. You know, it's like pimp's drinks. They had to have different pretty colors mixed up. My father ordered a beer. And when the bill came, I said, I got it, Dad. And I took out my American Express card. And I go, we don't take credit cards. And I had no cash on me. My father looked at me and said, you know, I just pulled out a couple of bucks. But we were talking, and maybe this is because we were estranged, but he said, you know, I read your book, you know, The Wanderers, right? It was okay. It wasn't like a good book or anything. And I remember at the time, I went, oh, you know, teach his own. But it was like, I always use this example, it's like falling asleep under a sun lamp. You're asleep, and then 3 hours later, you're screaming in agony. And I remember 6 hours later, or the middle of the night, he said, what? You know, but I was in shock when he said that. So I had sort of a, you know, calm reaction. But did it hit me in the head, you know, delayed reaction. But, you know, who knows? So, yeah, that was my father's reaction. And then when my career became more and more successful, my parents would say to me, every time I came over, they'd look at what I did, and they go, we didn't know. We didn't know. So, but you know what? They didn't. And they weren't evil. They weren't trying to destroy my dreams. They were just freaked out, struggling working class people. And I can't believe my kid went to Cornell, you know, and now he's writing. Is he writing for a newspaper? No. What is he writing? A book? A published book? Well, we don't know. I mean, they went insane with anxiety.
Thank you.
Okay.